I've lived in New Jersey my entire life, and I've been involved in lots of arts. Acting, writing, I even married a musician. But a lot of people don't think New Jersey is known for arts and culture. Well, they're wrong. And my goal is to introduce everyone to the most talented people I know. They're singers, they're writers, they're musicians, they're actors, they're chefs, they're martial artists, they're everything you can imagine, and they're going to be on my show. Every one of them. Well, maybe not every one of them, but a lot of them. So they're in New Jersey, and maybe they're not so famous, but maybe they should be. I'm Lucille Sapio, and this is Not So Famous in New Jersey. When you go away to college, one of the hardest things to deal with is finding new friends and trying to fit in, which is what everybody else is trying to do. I was lucky enough, I think, on my very first day at Rutgers University, Livingston College, to meet my guest today, Andrea Lyon. Now, Andrea is an incredible criminal defense attorney who's written several books, but her reputation is way more complex than that. She was the deputy public defender in Chicago for many years. She was instrumental in getting the death penalty overturned in Illinois by Governor Ryan. The Chicago Tribune named her the Angel of Death Row. She's been a law professor, dean of a law school, and now she has a thriving private criminal defense practice. But more important than anything, she's a really fascinating person and one of my very best friends. Hello, Andrea.
Hey, how are you?
Now, Andrea and I have known each other for a long time. In fact, she's my best friend from college, but she's known for other things as well.
That is the most important thing, though, Lucille.
Yes. Andrea is a very well-respected criminal defense attorney. In 2015, she was awarded Operation Push's Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and President Lyndon Johnson's Dreammakers Award. What is that for?
That's an award that's given to somebody who is contributing in some major way to civil rights.
So Andrea is a nationally recognized expert in the field of death penalty defense. But we're not really talking today about being a criminal attorney, although that is a huge part of her life. But we're going to be talking to her about the books that she's written, because she has been a very prolific writer. Not fiction, although some of it may seem like fiction when you read it.
Yeah.
She is the first woman to serve as the lead attorney in a death penalty case, and a very accomplished author. Now, Andrea, your first book, if I am remembering correctly, was a book called The Angel of Death Row. My life as a death penalty defense lawyer.
That's correct.
So this was more of a memoir than a legal book.
Yes. I mean, I had written legal books before, textbooks, law review articles, things like that. But this was the first foray into what might be referred to as popular nonfiction.
I know this, but I'm sure none of my listeners do. The reason that you named this book The Angel of Death Row is because that is what the Chicago Tribune called you.
They wrote a big article about me in the mid-90s when I was running the agency that represented all the death row inmates in Illinois. And so the publisher wanted me to use that name for the memoir, and I acquiesced, but it's a little embarrassing. I don't really think of myself as particularly angelic.
Well, the reason they called you the Angel of Death Row is because you only worked with death-eligible cases. Mm-hmm. And in every case you worked on, 19, every one of your clients did not get the death penalty.
Yes, that's right.
So that's what makes you the Angel of Death Row.
I suppose, but I had to put up with an awful lot of teasing, I got to tell you, about little angel wings taped on my office door and things
like
that.
And believe me, I went to college with her. She's no angel.
True.
So, now, you've written several books, and I'm really focusing on the books that a layperson can read and appreciate. So we have The Feminine Sixth, which is about women in criminal defense, The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive, and Fixing Legal Injustice in America, The Case for a Defender General of the United States.
Correct.
Of these books, which do you feel could potentially have the most impact?
The one that I hope has a great deal of impact is one that I just published not quite a year ago, which is the Fixing Legal Injustice one, where I am kind of telling the story of the criminal justice system through examples from my own experiences and from those of others that I know, and arguing that we have to do something to fix the criminal justice system in which there has never been a voice for the defendant, for the poor, for the accused. Every time there's any kind of legislation that's passed on the federal level, any kind of fundraising, any of all of that sort of thing, the only people that are at the policy table are politicians, prosecutors, and police. Never
the three P's.
Us. Yes. And so, for example, if I or someone like me had been able to communicate with those who were considering the 1994 crime bill that infamously really started mass incarceration, we could have told you what was going to happen. We know how those laws get interpreted. We know against whom they get applied, and that what would happen would be we would simply create another underclass of people who are incarcerated for huge amounts of time to no effect. No one can argue that the so-called war on drugs has been won, or even any battles have been won in it, frankly.
One of your books argues that we need a defender general. Now, do you really think that we need another area of government?
So one critique that I've gotten regarding the idea of having a defender general of the United States is the idea that I would be creating yet another level of bureaucracy that people would have to go through in order to be able to do what needs to get done. There's an argument for that, but we have to deal with these problems. We have a constitutional right. Someone who's charged with a crime where they could go to prison or jail has a constitutional right to a lawyer. And that constitutional right is just being abrogated everywhere. And one of the big reasons why is that there are no standards for representation. There are no standards for what is a reasonable caseload. There is no incentive to do this well. And so as a public defender myself, when I was in a felony courtroom, I was there with another public defender. The two of us divided up the cases there. And I personally had about 220 felonies at any given time. I just want you to think about that for a minute. 220 felonies. I work very hard, Lucille. I do. But I know I screwed over some people that I represented because I simply could not investigate every single case. I could not do the kind of legal research on every case. And what you end up doing is triage. What is definitely going to go to trial and what's going to go to trial next? And that's where you place your energy, to the detriment of people that deserve your attention and that deserve good representation.
Now, I'm going to be the devil's advocate, but aren't a lot of these people guilty anyway? You know, why should government money, our tax dollars, be spent to defend people who are criminals?
Well, that's because we have a constitution that presumes innocence, as it should, and because while you could make a promise that in your whole life you'll never break any law, and you could keep that promise, but what you cannot promise is that you'll never be charged with a crime. Anyone can be charged with a crime. And if you are facing the might of the state of Illinois or the state of New Jersey or the United States government, and that is a big foe to fight on your own. You need to have someone who understands the system and who will do the work that's necessary to meet that challenge. Are people guilty that I've represented? Yes. Are people innocent that I've represented? Yes. Are there people that I've represented where I just really don't know? Yes.
Okay, this leads me to the question, how can you defend a guilty person? If you are pretty sure someone's guilty, don't you have some sort of moral obligation not to defend them?
Actually, I have a moral obligation to defend them and to make sure that the government or the state has the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. The minute that something less than that is asked for, the minute that the accused is not afforded the constitutional right or the presumption of innocence, the minute that that happens, you slip into totalitarian land. That's what happens. Then you can just be arrested for having an opinion or for voting for the, quote, wrong person or for any number of things. And that is why it's really important that you have a vigorous defense, and not just for the defendant, but for the system itself. One of the things that's being talked about right now is what people refer to as the vanishing trial, because so many cases end up with plea bargains. And I'm not saying that there aren't cases where pleading your client is the correct thing to do, that is can be the right thing to do in many circumstances. But what happens is that the risk of going to trial is so high that people plead guilty even when they're innocent.
Yeah.
Because if they know that they're going to get probation if they plead guilty and they're risking 20 years even though they didn't do it, You have to make a calculation there. Mm-hmm. And that is the risk. And one of the byproducts of that, and this is a really sad thing, is that a lot of the misbehavior of the police or prosecutors is invisible because these cases never go to trial. And so when you have a police officer who's stopping people for driving while black, or you have a prosecutor who argues things that are clearly improper, or you have a judge that screams and yells at everyone, if you have those situations, conditions, but there are no trials or so very, very few trials, then that becomes invisible to the public. And the public does not know how many things go wrong in this world until we end up with a George Floyd.
Would a non-lawyer be interested in reading any of these books?
I certainly hope so.
I mean, these
books are not legal tomes. They are not textbooks. They are not how-to manuals for lawyers.
It's more about what the legal system is like in the country.
Right. And most of what I do in these books is I tell stories that illustrate what it is that I'm trying to expose. So if I'm telling a story about how the system is stacked against the defendants when in a felony courtroom, their public defender, me, had 220 felonies at any given time, and I tell a story about someone who got hurt by that, hopefully that will bring home to people.
It resonate, yeah.
Yes, because what if that person who was just charged with a burglary is actually innocent, and what if that's your brother or you?
You know my brother, too.
I do know your brother. I'm going to remain tactfully silent.
So yes. You've been an attorney for many years.
Over 40 years.
When did you decide to start writing more for the general public?
Well, actually, there is a story about that. My children are profoundly unimpressed with me, but one thing that they are impressed about is that I actually was on the Oprah show twice. And the reason that I was is that I represented one of the people that former Governor Ryan pardoned who was actually innocent from death row. I took on his case in post-conviction and proved his innocence. And so we were on the show, and she taped two shows at the same time. The governor was there. Three of the exonerees were there, including my client.
And Governor Ryan thinks a lot of you because I've met him and he really, really thinks a lot of you.
And vice versa. We're on the show and the John Howard Association couldn't get on death row. The ACLU couldn't get on death row.
To visit death row, not to be on death row, but just actually visit
it and see it. But Oprah is a law unto herself and she was able to get there with her cameras. And so some of that footage was being shown. And then during one of the breaks, Ms. Winfrey was talking about how surprising she had found it that in talking to these people that were on death row, some of whom told her they were innocent, some of whom told her they were not, that it hadn't really occurred to her that these were people beyond the crimes for which they had been convicted. Mm. And I remember sitting there going, if there's anyone who ought to understand what the depredations of racism and poverty and child abuse do to somebody, it should be Oprah Winfrey. And if she doesn't know, nobody knows. Yeah. And that's when I decided to write the memoir. Yeah.
No, we went to college together.
Yes.
By the way, Rutgers University, but Livingston College, which no longer exists.
Sadly.
So how did college prepare you for doing this writing?
I was the very fortunate recipient of an excellent education that was broad and diverse, that was arts, that was science, that was all the things that you wanted. And I went to school at a time where people were actively discussing politics, were interested in civil rights, wanted to try to make the world a better place, which is why, for whatever reason, I decided I need to go save the world immediately. You can thank me later. I went through school with two majors and two minors in 3 years and went to law school right afterwards. And I wasn't even old enough to drink when I started law school because I wanted to do something good for the world. And I was fortunate to be educated by people who thought that wasn't corny, that was a good idea.
So popular culture addresses legal issues all the time. What is it that people can learn about the criminal justice system through popular culture? I know there are shows that you think are terrible, like
yes.
Law and Order.
I hate that show so much. I think that the more that television and movies show the humanity of everyone, not just the, quote, victim or the prosecutor or the police officer or the defense lawyer or whatever, but the humanity of everyone, so that people can understand that there isn't just a good guy and a bad guy. There are flawed people with great things about them and terrible things about them. And what I have learned defending people facing the death penalty is, first of all, the line is thin and easily crossed. And secondly, that no one is only the worst thing they've ever done.
Mm. Talking a little bit more about popular culture, we know what probably your least favorite lawyer show is. What is your most favorite? What show about the law is one that you really liked?
Well, there have been a few over the years. Until it jumped the shark, I really liked The Practice. I thought it was very good.
Oh, and let's not forget, the Cameron Manheim character was based on Andrea Lyon.
Well, I think that it was. One of the writers knew me. And
she used some of your closing arguments in the show.
They did. The new Perry Mason show on HBO is excellent and does a good job of showing how nuanced and complex all of these human things are. Of course, I loved, and how could you not, How to Get Away with Murder?
I was just going to say that.
Well, and frankly, Viola Davis could read the phone book and I would listen. So I mean, that's just how I feel about her. That being said, an awful lot of the shows boil things down to the lowest common denominator.
Right, and because that's television. Yeah,
that's television. And it's hard to tell a long story that's not a soundbite, but it's what we should be doing.
Yeah. Anyone that's seen the movie The Fugitive, in that movie, Harrison Ford is Richard Kimball. He's charged with murdering his wife, and he keeps saying this one-armed man actually killed his wife. And at the very end of the movie, they end up finding the one-armed man, and they arrest him, and then he's exonerated. Now, tell us what is totally unrealistic about that ending.
Well, what's unrealistic is that you cannot get a new trial or your charges overturned if you got a fair trial in the first place and there were no legal mistakes made, which there didn't appear to be in the trial against Dr. Kimball's character, which would mean that even though he was factually innocent, that he would likely have spent the rest of his life in prison, which I know makes no sense to most people. But there are huge barriers in the way of trying to prove innocence once the train has left the station. Once there's been a conviction, undoing damage is extremely difficult. There are two states that do allow you to present evidence of actual innocence in what's called collateral review, that is, after the appeal is over. And those two states are New York and Illinois. Everywhere else, innocence is irrelevant. And in fact, the Supreme Court just made a decision which they said exactly that. Mm. It's irrelevant.
Yeah, innocence is irrelevant. Isn't that an interesting concept?
Yeah. It is.
So your mother was an acting coach, correct? Acting teacher?
Yes, she was head of the theater department at Roosevelt University. She was director and actress.
How is being in court like acting?
Well, you have to keep everyone's attention, which requires thinking about how you present as well as what you present. So that part of it is similar. I have found that juries and even some judges respond to sincere expressions of emotion, which I think are in court whether we want them in court or not, so we should pay attention to how people are feeling. I also think, though, that some of what's difficult about trying a case, I just finished a multi-defendant, multi-homicide case that took 2 months, and what's difficult about it is that it is not fast-paced the way that television is. And I don't know if you've noticed this or not, Lucille, but like if they're showing a conversation, say, between you and me on television, if you'll notice, they have, you know, the camera behind me looking at you and the camera behind you looking at me, and the camera jumps around a lot. And the reason that they do that is that if the camera angle doesn't move, people change the channel. And I sometimes joke, but it's not such a joke. I don't know what would happen if the jury had a clicker, you know?
You talked about this trial that you were just working on.
Yes.
What was the interesting thing that happened with the jury? And give a little background about how you can interact with a jury in a case like that.
Well, the only time you get to speak to jurors directly is what's called voir dire, that is when you're doing jury selection. After that, they're listening to what you are doing or what the prosecutor is doing or what co-defendants' lawyers are doing, etc. And in federal court, this was a federal case, you are not allowed to approach jurors after the fact. The jurors can approach you, but you can't approach them because they worry about something called impeaching the jury verdict, trying to undo what the jury has done, basically. Jury deliberation and jury decision making is, and rightfully so, none of the public's business. The only time anything that goes on in the jury room becomes part of the public's business is if there's misconduct, such as somebody threatening somebody, something like that, which I've seen in real cases. But the judge said after the jury, it was a mixed verdict. We won some charges, lost some charges. And after the verdict came in, the judge basically warned us, we can't go talk to them, but they can talk to you if you want. We had a few things to tie up after we were finished, and it went outside the courthouse. And 8 of the 12 jurors were waiting for me and waiting for us because they had so many questions and they were so disgusted by the prosecution's case, which relied on snitches, including 3 who were literally getting away with murder.
Mm. I mean, to me, that was maybe the best jury because
I've had some really wonderful experiences with juries. Let me give you an example that might sort of talk a little bit about how our own prejudices can get in our way if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying a case, and my client is African American, gay, and in a battered relationship with someone. Okay, few problems. And this was some years ago when people were not out very much. And he had ended up killing his boyfriend, live-in lover, in an act of real self-defense. But I was worried because I've got a jury. I've got race to deal with. I've got homosexuality to deal with. I have the whole battered spouse syndrome thing to deal with.
And murder.
And murder, yeah. Right. So I have all those things before I can even get anywhere near self-defense. And so I'm trying to figure out how to get this going. But I was very worried, as you might imagine, about how prejudice was going to play into all of this. So I looked around my potential jurors and I picked out, based on my own prejudices and my own stereotypes, someone who I thought would probably hate my client anyway. He had on the flannel shirt with a cigarette pack wrapped up in the sleeve, and he had on a cap, and he lived in one of the suburbs in Chicago that I think you had to pass a test to show how racist you were to get in. I mean, he was like absolutely not a good defense juror, speaking demographically and with stereotypes. So I figured, okay, I'll use him. So I start asking him questions about homosexuality. I start asking him questions about battered spouse syndrome and race. I'm asking him all these questions. And at a certain point, he starts to get this look on his face like, what? Am I on a television show? Like, what is going on? And I said, I bet you're wondering why I'm asking you those questions. And he said, you know, little lady, which was funny all by itself because I'm 6 feet tall. But anyway, he said, you know, little lady, I was wondering that. I said, well, let me explain. I said, now the prosecution's going to disagree with me here, but we believe we have a very good case of self-defense. But my client is gay. He goes, yeah, I got that. And I said, and he's in a battered relationship with the person he's charged with killing. So, okay, I got that. And he's black. I can see that, he tells me, right? And I said, and I'm worried that all of those things are going to get in the way of you being able to think about whether this is self-defense, whether he had a right to defend himself or not. And so there was this moment of silence. And I said to the guy, I said, should I be worried? And he said, oh, yeah, you should definitely be worried. And he turns to another juror that I guess he knows from the same suburb or whatever, goes, Joe, you got to, you know, you don't like those faggots. You know, you don't. You need to. He takes over and he starts doing a lot of my jury selection for me.
It's perfect. Right?
I know. And we kind of get on this roll and we're asking all these questions because I just want to have a jury that could hear the defense. That's what I'm looking for. If they can't hear it because they can't get past their biases, then I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
So when it comes time to, you know, there's two kinds of challenges. Challenges for cause, if somebody knows someone in the case or something like that. And then you have a certain number of peremptory challenges where you can just challenge someone because you don't think they can be fair or whatever. And I know the prosecution thought I was going to excuse him, but I didn't. Because I felt he had somehow become an advocate. And
actually listened to you.
Yeah, he did. And he got interested in the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I kept him. He was my foreman. And it was a 45-minute acquittal.
Whoa. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the thing. If, you know, there's a real difference between hearing and listening.
There's a big difference. Yeah. Unfortunately, in my profession, the difference between hearing and listening is a problem. We are much better at speaking than we are at listening to what people have to say. And we don't always make sure that we understand what someone is saying. A simple example would be, Lucille, you're like 5'4", 5'5", something like that, right?
Yeah.
And so if you said someone was short, that would probably mean someone closer to 5 feet. But I'm 6 feet. And so if I say someone is short, I might be talking about you,
yeah.
Okay? And so you have to take into account that people have different perspectives and make sure that you're understanding what they're saying and understand that most people think visually, not in the linear way that lawyers do.
Yeah. If you weren't an attorney, what do you think you would be doing?
Making trouble in some other kind of way. probably politics. I don't know. I grew up in the civil rights era. I wanted to be a lawyer because of that. I want to leave the world a little better than I found it. And I hope that I'm doing that.
And speaking of leaving the world a little better, let's talk about your book, The Feminine Sixth.
Okay.
Because those women did leave the world a little better. Tell me a little bit about that book.
The conceit of the book is that we're all speaking at a Women's History Month event. But actually what happened is I interviewed all of these women from all over the country separately. Some were at the beginning of their careers, some were in the middle, some were closer to the ends, some cities, some small places, black, white, Muslim, all different kinds of people.
All of these women were attorneys?
They were all criminal defense attorneys.
Okay.
The title of the book is sort of a play on the feminine mystique, being the feminine sixth, the Sixth Amendment right to representation. That's where the name of the book came from. It was very interesting to see how these different women experienced being criminal defense lawyers, some of us in the very beginning, like me, and some people who, for whom it's perfectly normal for women to be lawyers, some of the experiences that they had. This came out of a talk that I gave for the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, who published the book, about women in the profession. And what happened was, I was talking about being a pioneer, being one of the first. Somebody had asked a question about work-life balance, which always annoys me. But anyway, they did ask
me. They never ask men about work-life balance.
No, they don't. And I said, well, I'll tell you, I can remember when my daughter was, I don't know, maybe three, maybe a little younger, her pulling on my leg while I was sitting at the computer at home and saying to me, Mommy, who do you love more, your clients or me? Yeah. Of course, I told her it was her, but there's that pull. Like, you either have to be a monk and do nothing but work, or have a family, you can't do both. And I just don't accept that. I do not.
What are some of the things that made it a little more difficult for you, or just made it different for you than a man who was a criminal defense attorney?
I was the only woman in the homicide division of the public defender's office for a very long time. I mean, there have been plenty of women since, but I was by myself for quite a while. And my first day there, I had gone to court, you know, on some cases that I'd inherited from a lawyer who had burnt out. And when I came back, someone had taped pictures of dead naked women, autopsy pictures, above my desk. Welcome. So one of the things I learned to do to strike back and protect myself was to use humor. And so I went out of my office into the sort of central area where the secretarial and other staff sat. And I said, okay, someone got mixed up and put pictures of their girlfriend up in my office. I'm going down to the cafeteria to get some coffee. And when I come back, please get your pictures. And I tried to act like it didn't bother me. Of course, it did. Uh-oh, you're grinning.
If I were to commit a serious crime, what advice would you give me?
Before or after?
After.
Okay, because before I got to report you.
Well, yeah, no.
I got to report
you. If I've committed a serious crime, if I'm planning to commit a serious crime, or I'm thinking about committing a serious crime, are there any things that I should keep in mind?
Well, I'd say this a little tongue-in-cheek, but if you're going to commit a crime, do it alone. Don't tell anybody. And please, don't talk to the police. Just call me right away. AndreaLyon.com.
I have her number tattooed on my arm. Andrea, thank you so much. And you know I love you.
I love you back.
I love the arts, and I love to talk, and that's why I'm talking to local artists. And if you like listening, then subscribe to my podcast. You can do it on this page, on iTunes, or anywhere you get podcasts. I'm Lucille Sapio, and this is Not So Famous in New Jersey.